Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home. They don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you, we feed you, we feed you, we feed you.
Hello everybody, this is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 12 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Falling Numbers 101. But first, let me say there are a lot of things I like about a podcast. There is an immediacy in listening to another person tell his or her own story about a particular issue or life experience. While the printed word will always remain paramount to me, there are advantages when people speak for themselves without the filter of a writer interpreting events. Speaking of which, I've written a half dozen stories about falling numbers for wheat life since 2011, when the phenomenon first made significant waves in eastern Washington. For those who may be listening to this and not know what falling numbers is about, a quick primer. There are two ways to get low falling numbers. Pre-harvest sprout occurs when rain falls on a mature crop and the seeds inside the heads of wheat think, "Whoopee! It's time to send out a root." That's not good, because the process causes the starches in the seed to begin changing into sugars to fuel plant growth. For many years, the determination for this kind of sprout was made visually. Could the inspector actually see indications the seed was sprouting? Although the falling numbers machine has been around since the 1960s, it wasn't until the 1990s that Pacific Northwest customers began wanting their cargoes tested with it. The test can essentially see sprout before it begins by dropping a plunger through a slurry of wheat. There's a video of the falling numbers test I'm going to try and get for our Facebook page. But there's another way for low falling numbers to occur, and that's from what's called late maturity alpha amylase, or LMA, a phenomenon that's triggered when there's a wide variation between morning and afternoon temperatures for a period of time following flowering in the spring. It's different from pre-harvest sprouting in terms of where it occurs in the seed, but late maturity alpha amylase causes a similar effect, which also causes low falling numbers. At the Falling Numbers panel, sponsored by the Washington Grain Commission, held during the Pacific Northwest Ag Expo in February, Ty Jessup, Don Potts, and Aaron Carter gave presentations. Jessup is grain merchandiser for Central Washington wheat growers and a grain commissioner. Potts is regional manager of the Grain Inspection Program for the Washington State Department of Agriculture. Carter is winter wheat breeder for Washington State University. The whole thing was moderated by Mike Miller, chairman of the Washington Grain Commission. For this Falling Numbers 101, I had more than 2 hours of voices to work with and only 20 minutes of time to squeeze it into. Actually, more like 17 minutes with the intro and outro in this introduction. Just to let you know, I'm good, but I'm not that good. So I'm making an executive decision. I'm devoting episode 12, Falling Numbers 101, to Jessup and Potts' presentations, and will save WSU's Carter, the panel discussion, and Mike Miller's comments for episode 13, Falling Numbers 102. Enough of me talking. Ty Jessup plunged into his presentation by addressing an issue on everyone's minds.
Why 300? I mean, that's the question everybody always asks, is why are we... Why is 300 the target? Why is that the big issue that we're going through? When we ship a cargo of wheat overseas, you know, it's going to be a 20 to 60,000 ton cargo. It's going to have, you know, a 10,000 ton hold up to, you know, six holds of wheat. So there's a lot of wheat in this boat that's going overseas. And, you know, as the exporter loads them, they're taking samples, they're grading it. But within that big cargo ship, there is some variability to what that quality is. And so if you have a 300 target and you hit 300, you know, some of that wheat may be 280, some may be 320. So you've got that variability, and that's kind of why they have a target line there. They also, the overseas customers, they want a, you know, they produce a flour that that needs to suffice for all their different customers. So it needs to, you know, work across multiple product lines, you know, different kinds of products. So some products, yeah, maybe a 250 falling number does work, but others it needs to be higher. So 300 is just kind of a baseline. It works for all products. And so that's why our customers are asking for the 300. A lot of these, you know, you ship a shipment of wheat over there, a big mill takes it, he grinds it all up, he creates bags of flour, and they go to multiple companies that then have those multiple products and multiple customers. So it's just to create a consistent supply of wheat for all the flour, or the bakers and millers, or bakers in these countries. Our soft white wheat demand. The Philippines, number one buyer of white wheat. They normally buy min 320, min 330. I think this year they've backed down a little bit and done some min 300, but they are typically a 320 buyer, which, you know, our spec is typically is 300 as far as discounts go and what the market's requesting. So there's some, a little bit of risk there that an exporter will take on if he sells the Philippines. Our other big customers, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, Thailand, China, Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, Guatemala, Chile, Peru, Yemen, they're all min 300s. They don't have anything below that. That's what they buy. That's what they expect to get in their shipments. In these countries, they typically are buying from the U.S. You know, our demand for the Philippines is high every year. Japan, Korea, Taiwan. I mean, these guys buy wheat from the U.S. year in and year out. And it's to buy quality wheat. You know, they're not going to the Black Sea sourcing their milling wheat. They're buying U.S. soft white wheat off the PNW because of the quality of what our wheat is. And so that's their main driver, which means a lot of times they're paying more than the going rate for like quality of wheat around the world. Countries that'll buy below 300, Egypt would be one. They're a min 250 or min 200, I believe. We haven't sold any Egyptian cargo white wheat for a few years. Don't look to doing it anytime soon. Their terms are difficult to meet, and they're a price shopper. You know, you go years ago, 10, 15 years ago, they were they looked at FOB values. Now it's cheapest landed price. So Black Sea pretty much dominates that market year in and year out. Feed wheat. Feed's another source of being able to market low falling numbers. Again, it comes down to price. And, you know, at this point, you know, white wheat as a price is higher than in other destinations or other origins in the world. So what made this year different? One is the geographical spread. In 2016, we had falling numbers, you know, that was very widespread across the state of Washington. We've had them in the past. You know, 2013 was a bad year. 2011 was a bad year for certain spots. But this year is a lot more widespread. So one of the differences, you know, geographically was one difference. The other difference was the lows and the highs were lower than normal. So, you know, normally when we have a bad falling number crop, you know, you're dealing with some 250s maybe or 280s, you know, things that are a little bit below 300. And, you know, we can kind of work to blending those off internally. You know, the different grain handlers across the state and the exporter themselves can. So it's not, they're not as particular about the shipments they're taking. But this year our lows were a lot lower. I mean, the lowest sample I saw personally was a 61. The lowest you can absolutely get is 61. I mean, that has zero resistance to the plunger as it drops to, and you'll see that later. But so we had a lot of low wheat. And the highs were lower. You know, a lot of times, you know, you get white wheat that's going to be 400 to 450 falling numbers. You know, this year it was 330 to 350 was our high side. So that makes it a lot more difficult to blend up some of those lows when your highs are so much lower. You know, you're just barely over spec with your good wheat. The frequency of below 300 falling numbers, you know, in those, in that big geographic area, we had a wide area that had problems. And in some of those areas, over 50% of the crop was below 300. And that becomes very difficult when you don't have, you know, the majority of what you're dealing with is below spec of what the market wants. And the other challenge with that is the segregation. You know, as a truck's coming across the pit, we have no idea what that falling number is. So it goes into a big 500,000 bushel bin or whatever size of bins you're putting it into. And you've got 330s going in there with 200s and everything in between. So what's that week going to be when you come back out? I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty big gamble as to what the quality of that grain is going to be when you pull it back out of that bin. So that creates a lot of risk there as well. And some of you guys may have heard this, some may not. Falling numbers is different than, say, proteins or test weights. Proteins and test weights are a linear blend. You take a 10 protein and an 11 protein, blend them together, you get 10 and a half. It happens every time. It's consistent. That's how that blend works. Falling numbers is a logarithmic blend, so it does not blend one to one. You take a 200 and a 400, you do not get 300. You'll get something quite a bit less than that. So some blending examples. If you take a 350 and a 250, you get 290. So you would think it would work, but you don't. You missed the mark. So you take something even higher, go with that 400 and 200, you actually end up with 260. And then a 450 and a 150, it's a 210. So as you can kind of see, as you go higher and lower, the overall blend actually works lower. So kind of had touched on it earlier with our demand base, the Philippines, Southeast Asia. I mean, these guys like to buy high quality wheat. They're the best miller or best bakers in the world. Their milling practices are bar none. They're clean. I mean, they're cleaner than hospitals over here in the U.S. So these guys are very proud of what they do. And, for years, the marketplace, the various commissions, the wheat industry itself has been marketing the P&W soft white wheat as a high quality wheat, getting these guys to buy into our wheat, which they have. The rest of the world cannot provide the wheat that we do for white wheat and club wheat in that regard as well. So in doing that, the P&W has enjoyed being able to sell at higher prices than the world, generic world market for wheat. So a lot of people will ask, well, why don't we, if we can make 250 work, why don't we get them to accept 250? Because that will decrease the reputation that we have in the P&W. It'll take away the differentiation we have for high quality. And, we no longer have that premium product over everybody else. And so if you end up losing that distinction, all of a sudden, instead of selling premium wheat and being that premium origin in the world, you just become part of the price culture, and you're going to have to be competitive with the price in order to market your grain. And a lot of times the Black Sea wheat's significantly cheaper than we are, so if we have to do that on a daily basis, maybe we don't get a falling number discount, but your price is going to be significantly cheaper than it is today.
Don Potts has worked for the Washington State Department of Agriculture Grain Inspection Program for 37 years, and he's never seen a year like 2016. He hopes he never sees another year like it either. In that respect, he's not unlike a lot of farmers. He began his presentation by explaining why falling numbers are so important.
So just a little bit of a background on falling numbers and why it's important. Mainly before sprouting, and that's what the falling number was really the test was designed for. We see it visually, and there's a sprout discount that when we find it, it's discounted with the farmer. But it's a very visual tool that we have. But before the sprout even happens, there's a change in the enzyme in the kernel that happens. And this is what the test measures. It's the alpha amylase in the kernel changes the starch into sugar, and therefore it compromises the milling properties. This is what we're talking about when we're looking at sprout. Pretty visual. Our inspectors pick it. Shows on the certificate of sprout damage, and that was our usual cause of low falling numbers. This year was completely different. We knew we had an issue when it first started in a Pasco office, because they're the first ones that have the harvest early. They're probably a week and a half earlier than Spokane, and then we have Colfax. It's probably a week and a half to 2 weeks later than Spokane. So we had some low falling numbers come into the Pasco office, And what really caught our attention was a hard red winter sample that was about 220. We don't see, you know, in all the years that we've been doing this, we just don't see hard red winter, hard red spring below 300. It just really doesn't happen unless it's really sprouted. So our first inclination was, are the machines right? And then we found out that it was caused by LMA, which is a late maturing alpha amylase. In late June, early July, we had some temperature extremes. And if the kernel of wheat was in a flowering stage, that's what got affected. And this was the first time that we knew that it really happened. And it was widespread. And that's that brought the attention, you know, to falling numbers and what it's about, the process involved. And that's why we're here today, is to hopefully answer a lot of those questions that we initially had too. So this is what the falling number machine, indirectly analyzes the alpha amylase in the kernel. We create a paste of flour and add some water to it, put it in a boiling kettle, and the rods in there, it's like gravy where the rods come down, and however long it takes for those rods to go through the slurry is your falling number. So 300 falling number means it's 300 seconds. You know, the discounts happen when at below 300, hard red winter also below 300, and the hard red spring around 330 is when the discounts happen. The hard red winter and hard red spring weren't hit very hard. I think we had 12% of the hard red winter samples were below 300, and about 8% of the hard red spring were around 300. Even though the discount is 330, we're looking at 300. That's what my data showed. But then there's a calculation involved with a 14% moisture, and in Spokane and Colfax, there's an altitude adjustment. And you know, why is there an altitude adjustment? Well, water boils at a lower point with a higher altitude. So at sea level, water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. In the Spokane and Colfax labs, it boils at 98.2. So when you boil water at a lower temperature, you have a thicker slurry. So you have to account for that. So the number that we get really has to be the same as it goes over to the coast. So this particular falling number was at 242. One of the things that we're certainly doing, along with the Washington Grain Commission, WSU, we're looking at different kinds of technology. What we'd love to go to is, in the future, is near infrared whole grain analyzer, where it just, you don't ground up the flour. It's like the new protein machines, where it analyzes the kernel and does a 10 subsamples and then averages the results. And that's the technology that we need to go to. It solved all the issues that we had with protein. Protein, we used to use flour, and we had the same problems. We had differences of 0.4 in a protein. As soon as we changed technology, that all went away. There's no issues with protein anymore. So it's going to take a while to get there, but those are some of the things that we're looking at. Just a kind of a brief history of falling numbers, and one of the questions I get is, we didn't have these issues before. And it's not that we haven't had the issues. I don't think it's more prevalent now, for sure. I've been doing this for 37 years, and I've never seen a year like this year. So in 2006, that's when Colfax really started running falling numbers. Up until then, there wasn't a need for it. There wasn't a request for it. And they ran about 212 samples. Spokane got their first machine in 2008. And we ran about 381 samples. Pasco didn't get their machine until 2012, where they ran 857 samples. So you look at it in 2016, and we're still running falling numbers. To the tune of about 22,000 is what we've run so far. So obviously, something happened this year, and that was the late maturing alpha amylase. The last 4 years hasn't been very pleasant. Last year, we had a drought, so falling numbers wasn't an issue. But the previous 2 years before that was bad. We had pre-harvest sprout. We had untimely rains in August, and we were running between 5,000 and 6,000 falling numbers then. We thought that was a lot. But this year, we hope to never see again. It's a good year for research, and that's about the only good thing you can say about it.
Here, a member of the audience asks a question about the samples the Grain Inspection Lab uses to conduct its falling numbers test.
We can only analyze the grain that we get in. And so that's why, you know, there is a little bit of a difference. You know, when people send in they'll send in the original sample, and then they'll send in a backup sample. And that backup sample isn't like a retest. It's not the same exact grain that we have in our file bottle, but you know, the grain companies do a good job of taking samples and taking backup samples, using a Borner divider and making sure that everything is correct. But it's still, you're still not exactly the same grain, and it doesn't take a whole lot for the grain to have a variance. You know, we can see a 20, 30, 40 number difference just in the grain. And so the grain that we get is only as good as the sample that we get. So it's very important to take a good sample to begin with off the truck. And then when they break it down for the original sample to us and their backup sample, that is done properly too. So that when we get the same, we can always tell, because you can look at the test weight, you can look at the moisture, and you can tell if it's the same, pretty much the same lot. And that tells us quite a bit. The times when it's really far off, there's usually a difference in test weight and moisture.
This is one of those podcasts that is so important to farmers, it's worth a second listen. If falling numbers becomes a chronic condition of farming wheat in the Pacific Northwest, it's important we all know what we're talking about. Learn more next week right here when Aaron Carter, WSU's winter wheat breeder, and Mike Miller, chairman of the Washington Grain Commission, continue the falling numbers discussion on episode 13, Falling Numbers 102. Until next time, I'm Scott Yates, hoping you'll tune in again for another episode of Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.